The book is The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser. Chapter the Third. In the taproom, whither they had dragged him, battered and bruised as he was, Colonel Blood fetched his breath, while the gamesters reviled him, the wench giggled, one burly minion brushed the stolen coat, and another snarled, "Bide you there, ye muckrake, whiles I fetch a constable. 'Tis the roundhouse for ye, aye, and the gallows there are to damn ye." This seemed a reasonable forecast to Blood, who promptly swooned lower on his bench, gasping, "Water! Water!" at which they reviled him harder than ever, but relaxed their guard, with the result that one minion was suddenly rolling on the floor, clutching his groin and making statements. The other had the fine coat wrenched from his grasp. The colonel, a realist, knew that you can't get far in your shirt sleeves. And an iron fist smashed against his jaw, and before the wench could even squeal or the gamesters swear, Foxy Tom was off and running. Naturally, they pursued, minions, gamesters, landlord, bystanders, and other interested parties, including, eventually, the outraged husband, once he had recovered from his unexpectedly joyous reunion and hurried downstairs. And nip and double as Blood might, his beaten limbs, not improved, of course, by late nights, booze, women, and too much smoking the day before the match, would inevitably have let him down had his headlong flight not carried him suddenly out onto a long cobbled wharf, thronged with porters, hawkers, fishwives, seamen, loiterers, and all the motley of the waterfront. In an instant the colonel was lost in the shifting human tide, which bore him along while he got his breath back, straightened his coat, and regretted that he had no hat to complete the appearance of a genteel saunterer slumming. A great ship was making ready for sea, and Blood paused by her gangplank to look round for signs of pursuit. All clear behind, and he was about to stroll on when he saw, dead ahead, the breathless figures of the fat gamester and one of the burly minions moving questingly through the crowds in his general direction. The colonel wheeled smartly about, only to see emerging from the alley down which he had run a constable, the other minion, and in the rear the cuckolded husband, buttoning his waistcoat askew and inquiring thunderously about a black-avised rascal in a red coat. As heads turned and the two sets of pursuers continued to converge at random, Colonel Blood looked desperately for a bolt-hole. The gangway was before him, and his two seamen staggered onto it under the weight of a furled tarpaulin. He hesitated no longer, but used them as a shield to slip swiftly onto the ship's crowded deck. One quick look back showed him the outraged husband and the fat gamester hailing each other over the heads of the mob. Blood pushed hurriedly past a couple of barefooted seamen, rounded a pile of casks, and came face to face with a bawling red face in a brass-buttoned coat and cocked hat.
"Sink and be damned!" it roared. "And how in thunder do I know where the swab of a surgeon should sling his hammock? I can sleep in the scuppers. I'll be drunk enough not to notice. How now, sir?" it demanded of Blood. "What make ye here? We're putting to sea, or damn ye. No, we're not while them tarts and trollops are fouling my ship."
And he rolled furiously past Blood, a bosun at his heels, bawling the odds at the waterfront slatterns who were keeping his men from their work forward. At his instructions, the boatswain passed among them with a rope's end, belaboring them towards the gangplank, while all around the seamen hurriedly pulled ropes and battened hatches and shouted through cupped hands and spat resoundingly, doing all those things needful, d'ye see, to get a ship under way.
"Avast there! Get in the forrard plank!" yelled the red-faced man. "Yerly and be damned wi' a pox on it!"
Plainly he was another Farnall graduate, one of that barnacle-encrusted band whose natural ancestor is the bosun in The Tempest. the one who is responsible for the greatest stage direction Shakespeare ever wrote. Enter mariners wet. He rolled about the place, roaring and belaying, and then his eye fell on Blood again, and he bellowed, but with a certain respect for one well-dressed,
"Now then, you, sir, blast my bollocks and bar your leave. What, sir, what make ye, master? It's go ashore, go to Calicut, or hoist me for a lubber, what?"
And his gesture invited the colonel to the gang-plank, at the foot of which the fat gamester was plainly visible, craning his neck as he surveyed the crowded wharf. Colonel Blood had his choice, and he took it. "But, captain," said he, with desperate nonchalance, keeping under cover of the casks, "Calicut is where I wish to go. News came this morning. My rich uncle's dead of the flux, or the gout, or the fever, or summit. Shocking sudden, and the plantation going to the devil. I had your direction, and where the devil my man Jenkins is with the dunnage, God knows. Ye can give me passage, I dare swear."
"What, sir? Carry ye to Calicut, rot me? Why, sir, now, sir."
The captain rubbed grizzled chin with horny paw, and considered the appellant. Rich lace, good coat, rake helly, genteel, dressed in a hurry, but then he'd admitted as much.
"Why, your worship, it might be," he conceded. "A 4-month passage, let's see. I could make room in a pinch for 40 guineas now."
Above the ship's noise, a distant voice could be heard complaining,
"And the damn gallows bait had my guineas, too."
Colonel Blood did not hesitate, but pulled the purse from his pocket and tossed it over negligently to the captain.
"A bagatelle," said he,
and the roaring skipper promptly knuckled his hat and beamed, crying,
"Thank ye, your honour. I'll see ye have a comfortable berth, your honour. Crisp me liver if I don't. Yardley's the name, sir, Captain Yardley. Steward, hell's bells and hailstones, will ye lay aft, steward, dammy?"
The colonel was too old a hand to regret his lost cash. It had been necessary. The question now was whether to kiss it good-bye and steal ashore later, or to avail himself of this unexpected magic carpet away from London, a place which might be uncomfortably hot for him. India? He'd never been there, and had no great desire to go. On the other hand, he was one who had always lived where he'd hung his castor. Why not? He'd have 4 months' board and lodging in the meantime. As he considered, he lurked and presently saw his baffled pursuers take themselves off. The resolve was forming in his mind. He'd quite enjoy a sea trip, and the Indies, by all accounts, offered a fruitful field to men of his talents. He allowed himself to be shown his berth, shed his too conspicuous coat, and sallied forth on deck again to view the orderly bustle of the ship as the final preliminaries to sailing went ahead right handily, with cheery yo-hoo and bronzed backs bending to haul, pipes twittering, captain bawling, men hasting aloft, capstan turning, and that sort of thing, with salty baritones roaring,
"Where is the trader, O'Stepney town? Clap it on, slap it on, how the hell should I know?"
And up the gangplank, striding tall, came a superbly handsome young man in a naval coat and hat, his buttons glinting keenly at his surroundings. He bore a polished oak box under one arm, and his sea-chest was wheeled behind by an awe-struck urchin, whom he rewarded with a groat, a kindly word, and a pat on the head. The urchin went off, swearing foully at the size of his tip. But the skipper was all over the newcomer, crying, "Welcome aboard, Captain Avery, lookie! Here's jai or rattle me else!" The young man nodded amiably, but looked down his classic nose when the beaming skipper presented him to his fellow passenger. "Blood," he said, bowing perfunctorily, "I seem to have heard the name." And his tone didn't imply that it had been in connection with the last honours list. Plainly he was not enchanted with the colonel. Trust Avery to spot a wrong 'un every time. "You are a soldier, sir?" "Oh, here and there," said Blood easily. "You're a sailor?"
"I'm a naval officer," said Avery coldly.
"Ah," said Blood wisely, and wondered, "don't they sail?"
At which Avery's cuffs stiffened sharply as he favored the colonel with that steely glance employed by heroes on mutinous troops, rioting peasants, and impudent rake-helly villains, who respectively quail, cower, or gnash their teeth when exposed to it. Colonel Blood met it with an amiable smile, and the two of them detested each other from that instant. A coach came rumbling along the cobbles, and Captain Yardley swore picturesquely, excused himself to Avery, and stumped off, bawling,
"Admiral's a-coming, dammy! Ho, bosun, blister me bum! Lay up here, d'ye see! Hands on deck!"
And as the coach stopped by the gangplank, a massive-limbed figure, with an order on his silk coat and a ruffled castor on his head, stepped ponderously down from it, Admiral Lord Rooke, with a face like a ham, brilliant grey eyes, grizzled head, weather-beaten feet, tarred elbows, and all that befits a sea-dog of seniority and sound bottom. He was just what an admiral ought to be, tough, kindly, experienced, and worshipped by the salts of the navy, who referred to him endearingly as Old Pisquick, in memory of the time he extinguished a lighted fuse accidentally at the intaking of Portobello, or the outflanking of Marie Galant, no matter which. He bellowed a command in a voice which had blown lookouts from their crow's nests ere now, and a lackey leaped from the box and quivered in his livery.
"You're not English, are ye, fellow?"
growled the admiral.
"No, sir, please, je suis un frog,"
smarmed the lackey.
"Just the thing," cried the admiral. "On thy knees, rat!"
And as the lackey knelt on all fours in the mud, providing a step, a dainty foot emerged from the coach, shod with a trim-spiked heel and cased in white silk, and planted herself in the small of his back. A second dainty foot followed it, with a flurry of lace petticoat which revealed a modish velvet garter, buckled with brilliance below a shapely knee. And there stood the admiral's daughter, Lady Vanity, her tiny gloved hand holding a parasol, waiting to be helped down.
"Blow her away!"
bawled the admiral, kicking the lackeys behind, and the lackey subsided obsequiously into the mud, allowing Lady Vanity to step down to the cobbles, over which forehead-knuckling salts had laid a red carpet. Examine Lady Vanity for a moment. She was, of course, a blonde, whose hair shone in sun-kissed golden ringlets on either side of a roses-and-cream complexion, which she knew to be dazzling. Her eyes were sparkling blue, her nose haughtily tip-tilted, her little chin imperious, her lips a cupid's bow, whose perfection was no way impaired by its provoking pout. Practically everything about Lady Vanity pouted, including her shapely figure, which would have done credit to the Queen of the Runway. She was not tall, but her carriage was that of a fashion model who had been to a Swiss finishing school, and knows she has the equipment to stop a battalion of rugby league players in their tracks with the flick of a false eyelash. She was dressed by Yves Saint Laurent in pleated white silk, and her jewelry alone had cost her doting father all his last cruise's prize money. Lady Vanity was a living doll. Even the plump little negress, who was her maid, was pretty enough to be Miss Leeward Islands. Captain Avery and Colonel Blood stood together by the rail, drinking her in, one in respectful worship, the other with thoughts of black silk bedclothes and overhead mirrors.
"Will you look at that now?" invited the colonel in an enchanted whisper. "Maybe there's compensations to a life at sea, after all. I hope to God the old feller isn't her husband. Not that it matters." Avery's eyes blazed frostily at this lewd effrontery. This fellow's foul tongue, he decided, must be curbed, and speedily. Lady Vanity was surveying the ship.
"Are we expected to sail to India in that?"
she cried petulantly.
"Seen worse," growled the Admiral, and kicked the lackey again for luck.
"No doubt you have, father," said Lady Vanity chillingly. "But I did not run away to sea as a cabin-boy at the age of 12."
"You're still that cabin-boy's daughter, my dear," chuckled the Admiral, bluff as anything, "even if they call me milord nowadays."
He handed her aboard, and there were big introductions at the gangway, with Captain Yardley blistering and damning and apologizing with great geniality, milording and miladying and bowing as far as his guts would let him, as he indicated Avery, whom the Admiral hailed with delight.
"Why, young Ben, good to see ye, lad!"
He waved a great paw.
"My dear, this is Captain Avery, that fought with me against the damned Dutchman. My daughter, Lady Vanity."
Their eyes met. The brilliant maidenly blue and the clear heroic grey, and although the lady's glance remained serene and the young captain steady, atomic explosions took place in the interior of each. Captain Avery felt a qualm for the first time in his life. His knees may not have trembled, but they thought about it, and a great gust of holy passion surged up from his pelvis and thundered against his clavicle. Lady Vanity, normally careless of masculine adoration, which she took for granted, suddenly felt as though her silken stays were contracting and forcing a flight of doves up through her breast to her perfect throat, where they elbowed each other in fluttering confusion. As he took her hand and bent over it, murmuring, "Servant, ma'am," his mind was saying,
"Nay, not servant, worshipping slave and master and protector, all these and more."
And Vanity, whispering, "Sir," was thinking, "Oh, dreamboat," and feeling thoroughly ashamed of all the fan letters she had written in the fifth form to Prince Rupert, who had just sent a cyclo-styled autographed picture anyway. So they met, and as he raised his eyes to hers, and she for once shielded those haughty orbs neath fluttering lashes, their unspoken love was sealed like Bostick. Beside them, Dante and Beatrice were nothing but a Ted and a scrubber at a Palais Hop. She never even noticed Blood, who was giving her his pursed, wistful leer. Her attention was all for Avery, as she murmured softly,
"We shall be companions on the voyage, sir. You shall tell me all about the ropes and anchors and keel-haulings and things."
And he replied,
"I shall be even more enchanted than I am now."
With such a look of fervent adoration that she dropped her reticule. Blood picked it up, and she never even looked at him as she said,
"Thank you, my man,"
and passed on while Rook drew Avery aside.
"Ye have it safe?"
he asked, rolling an eye at the box containing the Madagascar crown, and Avery assured him that he had, and would bestow it secretly in his cabin.
"Aye," rasped the Admiral, in what he imagined was a conspiratorial whisper, "in your cabin, secretly, that's the word, but mum."
Possibly they heard him as far away as Chelsea, for he had a carrying voice. At any rate, Blood did, and made a note that the box which Captain Avery carried so carefully might be fraught with interest. But his speculations were now rudely interrupted by Captain Yardley thundering,
"Make haste, then! Bring her aboard, ye sea with a curse!"
And the passengers of the 12 Apostles turned to see who this might be. A barred cart had drawn up on the quay, and from it two sentries with muskets were manhandling Black Sheba, her wrists and ankles loosely secured by lengths of chain. Blood stared with interest, for the fetters made up most of her attire. her fine red breeches surviving only as a pair of frayed shorts, and her shirt little better than a rag. Her silver earring had gone into the pocket of her first jailer, and her hair was bound tightly behind her head, giving her face the appearance of a polished ebony mask from some Egyptian tomb. That, and her height, and the fact that she was struggling like fury with the sentries, made her a sufficiently striking spectacle to turn every head on quay and ship. The officer in charge grabbed her wrist chain and hauled her forward so violently that she stumbled and fell, whereon he shouted, "Get up, you slut!" and kicked her brutally in approved romantic redcoat style, which was a mistake, for she got up faster than he bargained for, blazing with rage and fetters whirling. The chain caught the officer across the face before the sentries hauled her back, writhing, and the officer dabbed blood from his cheek and swore most foully.
"Thou black vermin!" he shouted. "Ha! Wouldst thou, eh? Shalt learn the price of raising hand to thy betters, thou snarling slattern, thou! Sergeant, hoist me her up, and we'll have a cat to her."
The redcoats, having come provided for such contingencies as they always did in those days, in a trice Sheba was spread-eagle against the cart, her wrists lashed to it with cords, and the sergeant, a burly, grinning brute with bad teeth, who hadn't shaved, or washed either, probably, strode forward and tore away her shirt before flourishing the long cat-o'-nine-tails in a hand whose fingernails would not have borne inspection. The spectators stared, and dainty Lady Vanity clutched at the admiral's arm in maidenly distress.
"Nay, father, stop them! They mustn't!"
Her sweet soprano was tremulous with entreaty.
"Not in public! Can't they lambast her behind a building or somewhere?"
The sergeant spat a brutal stream of tobacco juice on Sheba's bare back, saw her flinch, roared with sadistic glee, and struck with all his might. Sheba choked a scream into a gasp as the tails tore at her skin. The officer gloated, "Nice one, fella!" And the sergeant was winding up for another stroke, when the cat was plucked from his grasp, and he spun round to face a reproachful Colonel Blood, who had vaulted nimbly from rail to wharf, and was shaking his head as he tossed the cat onto the dock.
"Wait till you're married afore you do that sort of thing, son," he reproved the sergeant. "You're too young altogether."
The officer surged forward, raging. "Who the devil art thou to mar our disciplining condign punishment?"
"Me," said the colonel innocently. "I'm a Tyburn hooligan, the kind that breaks up executions and gets spectator sports a bad name."
He beamed on the officer. "But I can see you're a man of taste, and you wouldn't want to spoil anything as pretty as this now, would you?" And he ran an appreciative hand over Sheba's shuddering bare shoulder.
"Avoid, upstart!"
hooted the officer, and Blood frowned.
"Och, don't be so hasty. Sure, it's a teeny scrape she gave you, and her just a slip of a girl. Use a little Christian charity,"
coaxed the colonel.
"You bloodthirsty bastard! Abate thy spite, and think on gentle things. Apple pie, and Christmas, and little lambs a-gambol, and your own dear old hag of a mother." "Damn thee, thou damned thing, thou!" shrieked the officer, fairly demented. "You'll answer for this!"
"Then so shall I," rang out a crisp, clear, well-modulated, upper-class, RADA-trained baritone, and down the gangplank strode Avery, all clean-limbed virtue. Sheba twisted her head to look, and forgot the smart of her back in a surge of relief. If ever you're tied to a cart and they're going to give you the business, an approaching Avery is just what you need.
"You're a disgrace to your commission," he chilled the officer, "creating a scene like this with ladies present. Stand aside, sir."
And the officer stood. Avery strode to the cart, and where you or I would have stopped foolishly, wishing we'd brought a knife, he simply reached up and snapped Sheba's bonds with two quick twists of his powerful fingers. Sheba regarded him with wonder, and as she turned from the cart he gulped and blushed, hastily averted his eyes, whipped a convenient cloak from the cart, and dropped it over her shoulders. "Off you go now," he told her sharply. "Mustn't catch cold. Aboard with you, and slip into something comfortable." Sheba, stricken into an awe quite foreign to her, was suffering precisely the shock which Lady Vanity had sustained a few moments earlier. It was the sort of thing impressionable teenagers used to feel when they saw Valentino or Paul Newman for the first time, that brave new world reaction of Miranda's. She fumbled the cloak round her like one in a dream, and moved unsteadily towards the plank, staring back at the Apollo-like figure of her rescuer, who was withering the sullen officer with a final glance. As Sheba reached the plank, there was blood, all casual charm, waiting to pat her wrist. "Don't thank me, darling. It was nothing." He smiled beguilingly at her, and she came out of her Avery and Drew's trance just long enough to spit in his eye before refocusing on the splendid captain as he followed her aboard. So intent was she that she tripped on her ankle chain and hit the deck with a blistering oath which caused the nearest seamen to press their knuckles to their teeth and stop their ears. Lady Vanity, looking down in disdain from the poop ladder, was heard to remark, "Fie, what a disgusting creature!" And Sheba, sprawled on the deck like Catwoman, glared up at her with diabolic venom.
"You should pray, my lady," said she in a sandpapered hiss, "that you never find out how disgusting I can be."
"Oh, now, baggage of midnight, will bandy, huh?"
Captain Yardley dragged her to her feet.
"Will lady a rank, looky, aye, and prime quality, as far above e as truck be above keelson?"
He frowned, considering. Yes, the truck was above the keelson, he was pretty sure.
He thrust her roughly towards the hatchway. "Stint thy hoydenish clack, or we'll have thee in the branks. You there, down wi' her and clapper in bilboes wi' a wannion."
He turned apologetically to usher his quality passengers to the poop, where they thrilled to the spectacle of the 12 apostles being warped from her moorings. Men threw ropes about and dropped tardy wenches over the side. Sails were unfurled and bumboatmen fell in the water. Articles of all descriptions were clued up, and the crowd on the dock sang the 17th-century version of Auld Lang Syne. The stench of bilge mingled evocatively with the rotting refuse of the river. The jolly sailormen swung their pigtails and strained at the capstan bars with heave and ho. Captain Yardley was quietly seasick in a corner, and only Blood spared a last glance, a leer, actually, for Black Sheba as she was hustled below. But even he missed her sudden start as a huge brute of a seaman yanked cruelly at her fetters with a coarse guffaw of,
"Ha-ha, me fine lady, allow me to show ye your quarters, a right dainty chamber, sink me."
He was a great bearded ruffian, all shaggy with red hair from crown to breast, and he quickly bundled Sheba out of sight. Blood sighed and wondered where they would put her. Maybe in some quiet corner where she'd be glad of a little company, provided she wasn't guarded by daunting thugs like that red-haired gorilla. Big, tough rascal, he looked. Come to that, these sailors were a pretty muscular lot. Blood's eye dwelt for a moment on another seaman lingering by the hatchway, a clean-shaven heavyweight in spotless white calico, who looked as though he could comfortably have taken 3 straight falls from Oddjob. Of course, the colonel mused, sailors probably had to be large and fit in order to cope with squalls and doldrums and other nautical hazards, it stood to reason. He dismissed them from his mind and set to studying how to cut in on Avery, who was explaining to a fascinated Vanity that the sharp end of the ship was at the front, and if you consulted the compass, you could point the vessel the way you wanted to go. She was astonished at his expertise. Admiral Rooke observed them fondly, and Captain Yardley, having dosed himself liberally with quells and Alka-Seltzer, stumped his deck and berated the topmen who were clinging to the futtock shrouds in lubberly fashion. Thus, with her strange human cargo, did the stout ship Twelve Apostles set out on her fateful journey to the far-off Indies, gliding down the Thames through a forest of lesser shipping which gave way, do you see, before her stately passage. Tall and proud she stood down for the open sea, dipping her peak to their lordship's flag at Greenwich, dropping the pilot off the Medway, bumping into the pier at Southend, and running down a shipboat off Clacton. Old Salts viewed her admiringly as she passed, and wished her a prosperous voyage, with ale mugs raised in half-stoned salutation, none guessing what strange destiny awaited her neath tropic stars beyond the ocean rim. Night found her in the Downs, pursuing her steady course beneath all plain and decorated sail. Her crew and passengers aslumber as she bore southwards. Did I say all? Nay, there were those that waked, the man at the wheel, more or less, and the lookout aloft, although he was surreptitiously reading a dirty book, possibly Moll Flanders, by shielded candlelight in the crow's nest. And others there were who as yet were sleepless. What thoughts, think you, reader, crowded their minds as they pondered the unknown future? How the hell should we know, says you? Then I'll tell ye, says I, and ye may lay to that. There is Captain Avery, strong chin and firm hand, his keen grey eyes veiled for once in thought, as he dreams of flag rank, naval glory, the Madagascar crown and his perilous mission? Or is he envisioning a perfect roses and cream complexion framed by gold ringlets, dreamy blue eyes, a small soft hand brushing against his own, a sweet musical voice inquiring, "What are scuppers?" Of course he is, the susceptible big jerk. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity, as far as he's concerned. And vanity, her petal-like cheek resting on her lace pillow, is drowsing fondly over the memory of that marvellous profile, that vibrant baritone, that strong arm that supported her up the poop ladder. If only he has 10,000 a year. Blood, too, has his thoughts as he lies in his berth. That big spade bint is a bit of all right, he reflects. Of course, so is Blondie, if a little upstage. Still, 4 months is a long time. Suppose he was shipwrecked with both of them? A happy dilemma, and the cad falls asleep with a blissful smile on his raffish countenance. And they weren't the only ones astir on the Twelve Apostles as she cruised gently south in the velvet night. Far below the waterline, in the nethermost bowels of the ship, in the foul reeking oarlop, where rats scurried beady-eyed in the dark, and the bilges slopped around with fetid splash, there, in a far corner, a light guttered palely, casting the shadows of three figures. Black Sheba, fettered by slim ankles to a bulkhead, reclined her shapeliness on matted straw, eyes agleam like eager anthracite, and with her the red-bearded gorilla and the tall fellow in white. You know who they are, but how did they get here? Listen. All the way to England, camarado, dogging the king's ship that brought you till we sighted Portland when we dropped ashore where Bilbo lay off, do you see? When we had word of where ye was bound, we shipped aboard as forecastle jacks, and, here he winked a shrewd calico jack wink, with a score or so stout lads as we can count on, look ye. Bilbo's been tipped the word and lays course south for a rendezvous agreed with Akbar the Damned and Happy Dan Pugh. And when the time comes, all right, merry meeting we'll ha' on it. Rack rat and rend me for a sea-slug else, chortled Firebeard. Ha ha! These misbegotten king's pimps don't dream what a flock of lovin' lambs they's got aboard.
and when Bilbo and the lads lays alongside, why, good day and good-bye to 'em, honest men. Then, little Sheba darling, gibbered the hairy scoundrel, ye can pay 'em for this salubrious accommodation and this jewelry they've given ye. And he jingled her fetters gleefully. Oh, friends, the proud, fearless sea queen, who gutted Spaniards before breakfast, and had been known to roast cathedralfuls of nuns just for laughs, choked back a sob of pure feminine emotion. A tear welled on her dusky cheek, and Firebeard wiped it tenderly away with the tail of his shirt, blushing coyly to the eyelids, the only part of him visible through his tangle of hair. "Dear comrades," continued Sheba, "I know not what to say. Shall we barbecue them first and keel-haul them after, or flog and carbonado them, and then disembowel and flay them by inches? Could we, perchance, do all six, and wound and dismember them later on? Oh, I know these are mere womanly fancies," she went on with a catch in her voice, "but it's been so long, and if it's the last thing I do—" She clenched her fists till her chains rattled and ground her pearly teeth. "I'm going to fix that stuck-up little blonde bitch in the Saint-Laurent outfit, with the puffed sleeves and those pleated seams going round above the hips and gathered in under the little bows along the back, so that it fits snug at the waist and looks as though it's creaseless material, and probably costs a bloody fortune to have altered, supposing you can get a woman to do it." "She won't," Sheba added venomously, "have much use for it by the time I'm through with her." "There, there," said Firebeard soothingly, patting her manacled ankle with his great paw. "She hadn't got near such nice legs as you, I'll lay, and I'll bet she sunburned something rotten, Calico?" "Patience, camarado," said Rackham. "There's long sea miles to go afore we call our reckoning. So, mum, and leave all to us." As they were going, Sheba suddenly checked them. "Calico, wait. When they were going to flog me today," she looked askance, and her voice was over-casual, "who was yon that loosed me?" "Which one?" asked Firebeard. "The cocky black Irisher, or the mealy swab with the long legs?" "The Englishman," said Sheba coldly, "thou untutored bladder." "Name of Avery," said Rackham, "captain in Charlie Boy's navy. Why?"
"Oh, nothing," said Black Sheba, and stretched herself like some great black cat on her straw, her eyes stoking up neath lazily lowered lids, a strange enigmatic quiver agitating her sensuously parted toes.
"A Canberra cruise this isn't, but who can tell what lies ahead as the 12 apostles skids round the corner of the Kentish coast, her passengers all unaware of the mischief brewing below decks? What dark purpose does Sheba harbour Avery-wise? What will come of his infatuation with the lovely Lady Vanity? Is her dress of creaseless material, and could it conceivably be altered to fit a corsair virago 6 inches taller? What dark schemes revolve in the fertile mind of Colonel Blood? How would you like to be chained up in an oarlop?" "Read on,"